It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 20 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5, Outward Changes in Rome, A Retrospect on the City Under the Empire. Part 1. The history of Rome in the Middle Ages must, on the one hand, deal with Rome as a city, and from this point of view, must inform us of its outward development, its general aspect, and its local fortunes at various epochs. On the other hand, it must not neglect the worldwide civilizing influence of Rome due to its position at the head of the Christian hierarchy. These two elements are related to one another almost as body and soul. The universal element gives moral life to the local besides true historical interest. Since all great events of ancient and Christian times were felt in Rome and there left their mark, its topography is historically important, for it shows the field of Rome's ecclesiastical and spiritual activity. Before dealing with the early history of the Roman hierarchy, we must therefore give the reader a clearer picture of both the ancient and classical city and of the ecclesiastical city as it existed at the collapse of the old Western Empire. Medieval Rome can be neither understood nor appreciated apart from ancient Rome, out of which it grew. Hence it is quite necessary to consider in detail the state of the city prior to 476. Yet since the early Christian monuments, as it were of their own accord, took up their place in the ancient framework, a curious picture of concomitant growth and decay is the result. This may be most justly described as the transformation of pagan imperial Rome into the Christian, and ultimately the papal city. This chapter is therefore essential to a history of that transformation of the heathen world into a Christian world, of that transformation from the classic into the medieval, which we have to study in connection with Rome and the papacy. To begin with, we are confronted by the question, in what way and to what extent can we know anything of the topography of ancient Rome? In other words, what are our sources of information, and how far can they serve to direct us at the present day? Many readers, unacquainted with such studies, may be surprised to learn from the details about to be quoted, from general descriptions we shall abstain of set purpose. How uncommonly exact and rich in information, in spite of all that has been lost, are the sources which still exist, and with what success recent scholarship has turned them to account. Traces of Rome's transformation found in the earliest plans and descriptions. Unhappily, the most important authority for early Roman topography is no longer available. This would have been the Severian marble plan of the city. Had the famous Forma Urbis of the 2nd and 3rd centuries after Christ come down to us intact, we should have before our eyes an exact reflection of ancient Rome. This colossal plan originally covered the northeast wall of the Temple of the Holy City, that is, St. Cosimus and Damian. Anyone standing on the open space fronting Vespasian's Temple of Peace, by simply raising his eyes to this wall, could follow the lines of the Roman streets, the ground plans of the buildings, and even read the names of the leading monuments and palaces. The Temple of the Sacred Herbs had been chosen for displaying this marvelous work because the census and survey rolls were preserved in it. The walls and the plan were about 65 feet in width and over 58 feet in height. The scale of the measurement seems to have been 1/250th, and it was based on the recent survey of the city undertaken by Septimius Severus. Its upper portion represented the northeast, and therefore was at variance both with our own maps, which bear from south to north, and with most ancient and medieval ones, which bear from north to south, that having been the usual custom since the time of Augustus. The desire to bring the most important monuments, particularly the new buildings of Severus on the Palatine, more prominently into view was probably accountable for the peculiarity. This massive map of Rome outlived antiquity, but at some unknown period in the Middle Ages it was destroyed. Perhaps an earthquake dislodged the slabs, or they gradually broke away of themselves and were dashed to pieces on the pavement of the Forum Pacis. They must then either have been covered over by later ruins or else carried away. At a subsequent date, great efforts were made to recover the precious fragments. The earliest known collection of these pieces, altogether 92, was discovered under Pius IV, 1559 to 1565, having been dug out at the foot of the wall. They were copied and soon were made a matter of study. In 1742, all the pieces then extant were attached to the wall of the staircase in the Capitoline Museum, those missing being restored from early copies. On the stairs, even today, they arrest the attention of visitors to the museum. Quite recently, the years 1867, 1882, 1884, and 1888, new, though less important fragments have been found, not only in the neighborhood of the ancient site of the plan, but at various points in the city to which they had been carried off. Some 200 little pieces were found in 1888 in the masonry of an old wall near the Tiber, to the rear of the Farnese Palace. In 1890, the ground below the old temple wall was once more most diligently searched, in the hope of finding further remains of this invaluable topographical source. Though the excavators, at great expense, pushed down as far as the pavement of the ancient courtyard, lying more than 20 feet below the level of the present convent garden of Saints Cosimus and Damian, only a few unimportant fragments of the expected treasure were brought to light. In 1899, other fragments, including one with the inscription, Ludus Magnus, were found under the Farnese Palace. The fragments have now been assigned a place in the museum courtyard and, as far as possible, arranged in the original order. Maybe some lucky accident will result in fresh finds elsewhere. On the wall itself, traces of the marble slabs and of the iron clamps with which they were secured are still discernible. Study of the fragments of the former urbis has already materially aided the cause of Roman topography, particularly since their publication and arrangement by Heinrich Jordan. He set himself to work to piece together the enigmatic splinters and to determine their respective positions, a problem which still affords plentiful scope to both intelligence and luck. We possess, however, written sources which are in many ways even more useful as guides to the ancient city. Classical authors frequently contain topographical details, though they are mostly mere casual allusions. Recently, these texts have been gone over afresh, and by the light of modern excavations, obscure references, which had hitherto puzzled the keenest philologists and archaeologists, have become perfectly clear. The services rendered in this respect by Giovanni Battista de Rossi, Christian Holsen, Rudolfo Lanciani, and others will ever be gratefully remembered. Among written sources we do not include the once esteemed writings of Publius Victor and of Sextus Rufus, for these supposed ancient works have long since been proved to be forgeries. The books fathered on these authors are merely arbitrary amplifications of one of the best genuine early documents which we possess relating to the topography of the old city. The document alluded to is the Constantinian register of the districts, called the Regionary Survey of the 4th century. It bears the name of the first Christian emperor and gives a list of the 14 urban regions into which Augustus had divided the city, with a short notice of the monuments, buildings, and streets contained in each. The document affords information concerning both the boundaries and contents of each district. It can be shown to be based on a plan of the city drafted in the days of Constantine, copies of which must have been attached to the description in the manuscripts. This chart has unfortunately been lost. Neither do the extant manuscripts contain the original catalog, but only compendiums or revisions made shortly after Constantine. The older is known as the Noticia. It dates from the year 334 and forms part of the so-called Philokalian Chronicle of the city and state of Rome. The later revision bears the title Curiosum of the 14 regions of Rome. It was written about the year 357 or a little later. In the Curiosum, the Constantinian catalog, on which both documents rely, is more faithfully reproduced than in the Noticia. Both the Noticia and the Curiosum have, however, also drawn on much older lists, some of which must date back to the first century. The Noticia and the Curiosum have each two statistical supplements in which the monuments are classified according to their character. The second appendix, the more summary of the two, bears in the manuscript the title of Breviarium. The two redactions agree in one respect. They mention no Christian places of worship, confining their notice to classical edifices. We may therefore assume that also in their model, the Constantinian catalog, no mention was made of the churches of the city. Some idea of this famous regionary survey may be formed from the following extract referring to the 8th city region. The monumental structures in this most important of all regions are dwelt upon at some length, the two redactions being, moreover, in comparative agreement. The 8th district, we read, known as the Roman or Great Forum, contains the three rostra, the genius of the Roman people, a statue, the Senate, that is, the Hall of the Curia, the Atrium of Minerva, the forums of Caesar, of Augustus, of Nerva, and of Trajan, Trajan's temple and his hollow spiral column, 127 feet in height, ascended within by 180 steps and pierced by 45 lights. It further contains the sixth cohort of guards, that is, their barracks, the Basilica Argentiaria, the Temple of Concordia, the Temple of Saturn, and that of Vespasian and Titus, the Capitol, the Golden Milestone, the Vicus Ugarius, the Greco Stadium, the Basilica Julia, the Temple of the Castors, Vesta, and the Horia Agrippiana, the Fountain with the Four Fishes under it, the Atrium of Cacus, the Portus Margaritaria, the Elephas Herbarius. This region comprises 34 vici, that is, quarters, into which each region was subdivided. 34 aeduculae, small temples of the Larus Compitalis, corresponding in number to the quarters of each district. 48 vico magistri, 2 curatores, 3,480 insulae, that is, tenement houses for people of limited means. 130 domus, or mansions, 18 horiae, 85 baliniae, that is baths or balneae, 120 lacus, that is fountains with basins, 20 pristini, that is public bakeries in connection with the Annona. The district covers 13,067 feet. In such wise, tersely and authentically, does the Constantinian Chronicle impart its information. In the study of Roman topography, it is this document which has the first claim on our consideration. The 5th century supplies a similar compilation, of much smaller size and entirely dependent on Constantine's catalog. This is the Latercullus, or Calendarium, of Polemius Silvius, dating from 449, and entitled, What There Is at Rome. Quae sit Romae. The author, probably a cleric, passes over the names of heathen temples in utter silence. As for the places of Christian worship at Rome, though he mentions no churches by name, he at least remarks generally there are there religious edifices with innumerable hallowed crypts of the martyrs. From this we may gather that the Latercullus was as yet unable to break away from the customary form of ancient official lists. The 6th century compilation of Zacharias of Mytilene is simply a repetition of the above-mentioned breviaria, with some trifling additions. Zacharias, bishop of Mytilene, in the island of Lesbos, incorporated the breviaria in his Greek church history, which has come down to us in a Syriac version. The little that he adds to what was previously known is of a legendary character and forms the starting point for all the legendary literature regarding Rome, which we come across in the medieval Mirabilia Urbis Romae. Concerning the topography of the earliest churches, nothing can be gleaned from Zacharias. It is noteworthy that the author, in the midst of his trite statements, cannot suppress a passionate lament over the fate of the city, ravaged by barbarian hordes, though he goes on to express his hope that Rome will rise again in fresh and even greater glory, the city being the honor of the entire Roman Empire. For the origin and number of Christian places of worship, we are thrown back upon the notices of new ecclesiastical buildings in the famous Liber Pontificalis, where, however, the catalogue is by no means complete, on the lists of churches appearing among the signatures of certain Roman councils, and on scattered notices, among which the itineraries of early Roman pilgrims are both interesting and instructive. The itineraries form a literature apart. From very early times, lists of the curiosities and sacred sites of Rome, with topographical and historical remarks, have been compiled for the use of the numerous visitors to the city. The itineraries which have come down to us deal especially with the catacombs and with the inscriptions. All these have been put together by De Rossi in the first volume of his work upon Roma Subterranea, and in the second volume of his Inscriptiones. Among these itineraries, that of the greatest importance for the churches inside the city was published by Eckhart in 1729 and again by De Rossi after two Salzburg manuscripts now preserved at Vienna. Its title runs, On the Holy Places of the Martyrs. In an appendix, a list is given of the so-called station basilicas of Rome, that is, of those churches where the population was wont to assemble for the liturgical functions of the stations. This little book, carried home by a German pilgrim, dates from the pontificate of Honorius I, 625 to 638. It seems, however, to have been compiled from an earlier similar guide, drawn up not later than the time of Pelagius II, 579 to 590. Incomparably fuller information about the city is to hand in the so-called Isidon itinerary, for this also deals with its secular aspect. It belongs to the second half of the 8th century. This handy guidebook of an unknown author, which names the places and monuments in the order they are met with, brings Rome before us as it existed long before the time of the writer, even in the days of its transition from antiquity to the Middle Ages. Its topographical indications are also relatively accurate and clear. The guide follows several routes, usually proceeding from one city gate to another. He distinguishes carefully the right from the left-hand side of the road and mentions the classical or ecclesiastical buildings which are seen on the way either in the distance or close at hand. It is characteristic that he has scarce a word to say of the former heathen temples. The booklet, or rather roll, for it consisted in a rolled strip of parchment, to be gradually unfolded as the pilgrim progressed, must also have been accompanied by a map or plan of the city. At any rate, it seems as though the names mentioned are taken from such a plan, according to the order in which they are arranged. Recent excavations have more than ever established the great services which this itinerary has rendered for the determination of the main arteries of imperial Rome, through which the pilgrims rambled. It has become clear that the former main thoroughfares of Rome were still in use in the days of the Einsiedel guide, that is, at the time of Charles the Great. Even as regards its principal monuments, Rome's aspect had not greatly changed as late as the 8th century. The city map on which the guide was based must also have tallied with that of the Constantinian Regional Survey, the lost plan of the city being probably nothing else than a new edition brought up to date of the Constantinian Survey. The next three centuries furnish us with no topographical notices worth naming. After this period of silence, we come across a sort of itinerary of the streets of Rome in the Ordo Romanus of Benedictus Conaticus, belonging to the 12th century. it is a tolerably exact program of the processions. But by that time, a great change had taken place in the topography of Rome. The ancient city was already in so ruinous a condition that many of the old thoroughfares had become impassable. Some had probably quite disappeared and had been replaced by new ones, often running in entirely different directions. Quite recently, the authorship of the Mirabilia Urbis Romae, a guide for the use of foreigners, containing a few valuable details amidst great wealth of legend and historical falsehood, has been ascribed to Benedictus. The first plan of the city of Rome, which has come down to us, belongs to a date not much later than that of Benedictus Conaticus, that is, if we may call the drawing in question a plan, since to tell the truth, it is rather a view. It is contained in a 13th century manuscript of the Vatican Library. Recently, a copy of this same plan, dating from the 14th century, has been found in the Marciana at Venice. The 15th and 16th century, with their enthusiastic devotion to the classical studies of antiquity, have bequeathed us a perfect mine of valuable materials for the better understanding of ancient Rome. We allude to the copies of inscriptions and the notices bearing upon old buildings then still extant in the city, but most of all to the wealth of architectural and artistic sketches which sculptors, painters, and architects collected for their work. A new era for topography has begun since these sketches in our own day have been arranged and rendered accessible to all. To this end, most valuable assistance has been rendered in Italy by the libraries of Florence, Siena, Venice, and Rome, as well as abroad by those of Paris, Berlin, Stuttgart, Oxford, Windsor, and of the Escurial near Madrid. All written sources are, however, little more than marginal notes to that book, which the Rome of today, with all its remains of antiquity, unfolds before us. The city itself offers us its history fully and clearly immortalized in stone. End of section 20. Section 21 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5, Outward Changes in Rome, A Retrospect on the City Under the Empire, Part 2. The Excavations. The excavations of the past century have revealed with growing certainty the topographical changes which have occurred in the course of Rome's history. During the past few decades, such masses of detail connected with ancient Rome have been brought to light that the book, which till now seemed so mysterious, has furnished the key to its own secrets. As regards the greater part of the surface of ancient Rome, present-day topographical science is no longer forced to stumble about with no guide but some more or less obscure texts and a few discoveries, nor to be content with mere inferences and conjectures. The archaeologist may now, so to speak, measure with his foot rule monuments whose very existence was once questioned, and from the early pavement itself laid bare, learn the course of the ancient city streets. Patient research of previous days, bearing on the literary texts and inscriptions, prepared the way for a more personal contact with imperial Rome, which commenced in recent years, when scientific excavations began to be conducted side by side with the study of early texts. Even under the Napoleonic government, important ancient structures had been brought to light, the first of them being the Roman Forum. The difficulties to be overcome were exceeding great, on account of the enormous accumulations of new soil. To give one instance, under the tabularium of the Capitol, earth and rubbish, to a depth of more than 30 feet, had to be removed to lay bare to their base, as we see them now, the three exquisite pillars which adorn the corners of Vespasian's temple. From 1809 to 1814, efforts were directed to clearing the Colosseum, Constantine's great basilica, the temples of Venus and Roma, and the golden house of Nero below the baths of Trajan. At the same time, work was being carried on at the temple Boarium. The rubbish was removed from the Arch of Janus Quadrifons, from the temple of Mater Matua, popularly known as the temple of Vesta, and to some extent from the temple of Fortuna Virilis. Preparations were also made for the successful excavations at Trajan's Forum and the Basilica Ulpia. When Pius VII had regained possession of Rome, he actively prosecuted the work begun under French auspices, especially the excavations on Trajan's Forum. Succeeding popes followed in his footsteps, so far as their means and the proprietary works of others allowed. Even during the agitated pontificate of Pius IX, excavators were not idle. The Palatine Hill, with the former imperial residence, was then explored at the joint expense of the papal government and of the ambassadors of Napoleon III. At the same time, the investigation of the Christian catacombs outside the walls and the laying bare of the pagan tombs which fringed the Appian Way were vigorously proceeded with. The newest stage in the history of Roman exploration, as we all know, was consequent on the occupation of the seat of the papacy by the Italian government in 1870. Side by side with the lamentable moral revolution, a certain topographical rearrangement began in the new capital of the kingdom, which unfortunately threatens to put the stamp of modernity on the venerable features of the great Christian metropolis. We are not, however, concerned with either the moral or physical transformation of Rome, but merely with the great and scarcely expected archaeological results which followed, and which, so far, have hardly received the attention they deserve. During the period from 1872 to 1889, new streets were laid out, and broad stretches of land lying between the ruins and the vineyards, particularly on the hills, were handed over to the speculative builder. During the whole of this time, almost every day, some priceless antiquarian treasure was dug out of the trenches. The author, whose privilege it was to sojourn repeatedly at Rome during those years, among other enthusiastic archaeologists, both Italian and foreign, still recalls with pleasure the general rejoicings. The excavation seems to have brought us to the very soil of the promised land. It is regrettable that haste was responsible for the loss of many a relic of early and particularly of medieval Rome, but it must be acknowledged that Italian, Roman, German, French, and English antiquaries were, on the whole, allowed to work freely and advantageously, not without a certain scientific and patriotic rivalry, at excavations leading at almost every step to discoveries. The finds having, most of them, been photographed, have been made available for future study. Simultaneously, the Italian government, thinking it due to its reputation, undertook further systematic excavations of important early edifices, even where modern building operations did not call for them. The remains unearthed were, with some ostentation, placed under state protection, the results being published and discussed in the newly started official journals. In fact, it is not too much to say, if we wish to express our progress in a single sentence, that more has been learnt about Rome during the last few decades than during a century under the hindrances hitherto prevailing, and with merely philological instruments. Of course, the Roman building fever was followed by the inevitable reaction. Since the financial crisis of 1889, not only have building operations gradually flagged, but even the government has been forced to reduce its scientific investigations to very modest proportions. During this pause, archaeologists were, however, able to resume their studies, and this with great profit, as they were now free to revise and digest at leisure the vast amount of fresh material which had been acquired. Thus, for instance, Rodolfo Lanciani, a Roman who took a leading part in the excavations, is now publishing the great Forma Urbis Romae, whilst the essays of Christian Holsen and of the other members of the German Archaeological Institute in Rome, which are always full of fresh information, are intended to collect and render the recent discoveries generally available. The Forma Urbis just alluded to is, as it were, a reproduction of the enormous marble plan of Severus on the temple wall above the Forum of Peace. With the most recent results, Lanciani here unites all that has been discovered and verified in the past. He has been equally diligent over the Christian monuments, even including such as date from the Middle Ages. Previous plans of Rome, particularly that by Canina, 1848, may have been of great value in their day. By this time, however, they are quite obsolete. anyone relying upon them, as Gregorio Villas did in all the editions of his History of the City of Rome, would be liable to mistakes at every step, as it is easy to realize by glancing at Lanciani's Forma Urbis. The best-known district of ancient Rome is at present the Fifth or Esquiline. The lion's share of recent research was bestowed upon it, and it has been brought to light almost in its entirety. The next is the Tenth or Palatine region, which has almost entirely divulged its hidden treasures, thanks to the earlier explorations continued down to our day. In the Sixth district, Alta Semita, a great part of the buildings have been examined, also in the Eighth or Forum Romanum, as well as the 11th or Circus Maximus. Two other districts, the 12th and 13th, or Piscina Publica, and the Aventine, have also been very carefully investigated at various important points, while in the remaining regions, so many discoveries have been made at various times that they can in great part be reconstructed on the map. While reserving other data for later treatment, we shall here enumerate tersely, drawing our information from a compilation of Lanciani's, the archaeological works of art yielded by the soil of Rome from 1872 to 1887, that is, during only 15 years, and now treasured at the Capitoline Museum. The list shows how astonishingly fertile this little corner of the globe still is in relics of classic times, and also what strides topography has made. The finds comprise no less than 1,864 inscriptions on marble or other stone, 77 pillars of rare marble, 313 fragments of columns, 157 marble capitals, and 118 pillar bases, 192 well-preserved marble statues, 21 figures of animals, 266 busts and heads, 705 amphorae, many bearing important inscriptions, 2,360 clay lamps of various and frequent artistic shapes, 590 odd items of earthenware, 405 articles in bronze, 711 jewels and cameos, 18 marble sarcophagi, 152 marble figures and scenes in bas-relief, 54 colored mosaics, 47 objects in gold, 39 in silver, and no less than 36,679 coins in gold, silver, and copper. Finally, an incalculable quantity of fragments belonging to works in clay, ivory, glass, horn, enamel, stucco, and so on. Almost all this was yielded by the hills, not by the low-lying districts of ancient Rome. End of section 21. Section 22 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5, Outward Changes in Rome, A Retrospect on the City Under the Empire, Part 3. Site of the City, Bridges and Hills. During the Empire, the flat reaches of the Tiber were less inhabited than the hills, which form a girdle round the lower part, or so-called Campus Martius, though during the Middle Ages, and in fact till recent times, the actual city and its busiest streets were situated in the hollow. This plain was singled out for the erection of magnificent monumental edifices, and was adorned with a series of arcades, where people could walk and talk and admire the artistic treasures. The seven famous hills on the left bank of the Tiber stand almost in the center of the broad stretch of land, bounded by the Apennines on the east and by the sea on the west. Together they form an elevation, eminently adapted to become the site of a city and a center of throbbing life. These hills of volcanic origin lift their heads at a distance of some 15 miles from the sea. They stand in the Campagna, that picturesquely undulating plain, varied by verdant hills stretching from north to south, that is, from the Ciminian and Tolfa mounts to the steep cliffs of the Volscians at Terracina, a distance of about 95 miles. The Campagna on the east side extends to the limestone hills of the Apennines, some 15 miles from Rome, that is, at a distance approximately the same as that of Rome from the sea. The river which drains this historic ground added much to the means of defense, as well as to the salubrity of the city situated on the heights. It was the main artery for the traffic which flowed towards Rome from the fruitful regions of central Italy. By uniting the city with the sea and with the lands beyond, the river Tiber was a potent factor in the worldwide influence attained by Rome. The Tiber has one tributary, the Anio, or Teverone, which joins it 4 or 5 miles above Rome. Its southern course skirts the hollow occupied by the Campus Martius at the base of the upper city. Here the river forms two great reaches, its waters being first turned back by the slight elevation of the Campus Martius at the Mausoleum of Augustus near the Porto di Ripetta. The elevation here is so slight that on this side the Campus Martius is constantly exposed to the risk of inundation, as is sufficiently proved by the records of 23 floods experienced during antiquity. The river again winds at the point where, bending still more sharply to the east than before, it encircles the old island of Aesculapius, and is then forced back by the foot of the Capitoline Hill. After quitting the city and receiving several small streamlets from the western Campania, it is joined about midway between the Aurelian city wall and the Basilica of St. Paul by its other tributary, the small river Almo, the so-called Marana del Acquitasio, which flows from the heights of Marino. During imperial days, a great many bridges joined the city on the left bank with the sparsely populated right bank. The most northerly bridge was the Pons Aelius, now known as the Ponte Sant'Angelo. The belief that there was a so-called triumphal bridge still higher up has latterly been proved a mistake. The Pons Aelius was specially built by the Emperor Hadrian to connect his magnificent mausoleum, now the castle of Sant'Angelo, with the city. Recent work at this spot has proved that a causeway led directly from the bridge to the mausoleum. To the left of the bridge, an inclined way ascended in the direction of the Vatican Hill, towards St. Peter's. A similar one on the right led to the gardens of Domitia, that is Prati di Castello. The Pons Aelius is the only ancient bridge at Rome in a tolerable state of preservation. Besides the three main arches in the middle of the Tiber, and a smaller one, which was always visible on the city side, two yet smaller arches on this same side came to light only in 1892, during the progress of the work of embanking the river. When the later masonry had been cleared away, it was interesting to note how gracefully the original structure rose from the city plain. On the opposite bank, besides one already known before, there stood a second and lesser arch. Originally, the Pons Aelius had therefore 8 arches. The difference in height of the side arches was due to the variable water level. Below the modern pavement of the bridge and the underlying medieval equivalent, the workmen came across the original pavement, formed of large polygonal stones. Farther downstream, but not far from the first, stood the second bridge, the Triumphal Bridge, or Bridge of Nero. It was erected by Nero to give access to the Vatican, and also to his circus. At an early but unknown date, it either fell into decay or was deliberately removed. When the water is not too high, remains may still be seen in the middle of the river, opposite the hospital of Santo Spirito. Still farther down came the third bridge, called the Pons Agrippe, near the present Farnesina Gardens. Its existence was first heard of in 1887, when its remains and an inscription were discovered. Most likely, it was removed as early as the beginning of the 3rd century. The fourth bridge, or Pons Aurelius, was built at about the same time. After undergoing substantial alterations, it has become the Ponte Sisto. On account of its situation, it was in olden times the most important and most frequented bridge in Rome. An ancient, perfectly straight street, now in its latter part, called Via dei Pettinari, coming from the Porticus and Theatre of Pompey, led across it to the Via Aurelia Vetus, which in its turn ascended to the citadel of the Janiculus, and thence to the Aurelian Gate. The bridge was sometimes called Pons Janiculensis, from the Janiculus. Its old popular name was Pons Antonii, after its founder, Antonius Caracalla. The Emperor Valentinian had this bridge restored and embellished, giving it the name of Pons Valentiniani. During the Middle Ages, it lay in ruins and was therefore known as Ponte Rotto. It appears that during a great inundation under Pope Hadrian I, 772-795, it was destroyed, or at any rate, so much injured that it gradually became impassable. Pope Sixtus IV at last rebuilt it on the old foundations in its present form, when, on the occasion of the Jubilee, 1475, he restored many important public buildings. The fallen ruins of the monumental Valentinian Bridge were religiously preserved by the Tiber and yielded up to us in our own times. When, in 1878, the river was dredged and embanked, so many fragments of masonry, much of it carved, came to light, that it would have almost been possible to reconstruct with them the bridge as it appeared under Valentinian, with its ancient piers and stone parapet, with the dedicatory inscription of this ruler and his joint emperor, even down to the marble slab, the figures on which indicated the height of the water. It was found that the bridge began on the city side, with a triumphal arch on which the gilded bronze statues of Valentinian and Valens must have stood. A wing of the same metal, drawn out of the Tiber and now in the National Museum, belonged to a statue of Victory, which adorned either the bridge or the arch. An inscription discovered states that Lucius Aurelius Avianus Symmachus, prefect of Rome in 364, dedicated this figure to the two emperors. This city prefect was the father of St. Ambrose's famous opponent, Quintus Aurelius Symmachus, who took up the cudgels on behalf of the statue of Victory in the Senate. The find would seem to show that Victoria was particularly revered among the Symmachi. Archaeological discoveries occasionally thus allow us, as it were, to read between the lines and catch a passing glimpse of many a detail of life in early Rome. These discoveries must, therefore, not be made light of, however trivial they may sometimes appear. The fifth and sixth bridges bring us down to the Tiber Island, once sacred to Aesculapius, and so walled in as to represent the shape of a ship and form a natural bridge pier. The Pons Fabricius led to it from the city, the name of its founder still being visible on either side of the bridge. During the Middle Ages, it was frequently styled Pons Iudaeorum from its proximity to the ghetto. Still later it was called the Ponte di Quattro Capi because of the two four-headed figures of Hermes built into it at the entrance. Owing to the recent embanking of the river, the arm which used to flow under this bridge has been completely silted up, and for the first time in history, it was possible to be sarcastic at the expense of its builder, Fabricius. The continuation of the bridge last mentioned was the Pons Sestii, now called the Ponte San Bartolomeo, linking the island with the Trans-Tiberine region. After restoration by the Emperor Gratian in 370, this name was changed to Pons Graciani. A long inscription on the inner side of the breastwork has preserved the name and a record of the work of this emperor. Besides Gratian, the joint emperors, Valentinian and Valens, are mentioned, and all three, in spite of their being Christians, among other grandiloquent titles, bear that of Pontifex Maximus. In this case, it is, however, an empty formula by which emperors were wont to assert their possession of the outward privileges which once belonged to the chief priest. In the marble, the places may still be seen where statues of these emperor pontiffs once stood. The Pons Graciani has contrived with great difficulty to survive the recent Tiber works. In the course of the work, it had to be taken entirely to pieces, but in 1892, it was again erected with the old materials and also lengthened. It was then seen that even in Gratian's time, a goodly portion of the ancient blocks had been taken from the walls of the theater of Marcellus close at hand. Hence, even in those early days, they had begun to restore public monuments at the expense of earlier edifices for which they had no further use. According to a debased inscription, also on this bridge, it was in an almost ruinous condition, when in the 10th century, Benedict, chief senator of this illustrious city, Alme Urbis, summa senator, was pleased to confer on it the benefit of a restoration. The Aemilian or Palatine Bridge was the seventh bridge in Rome and stood just above the recently erected Palatine Bridge, which perpetuates its predecessor's name. a picturesque relic of the old one, is still visible in the riverbed. The name so often appearing throughout the Middle Ages, Pons Maior, Pons Senatorum, Pons Sancte Mariae, all denote this bridge. After having been frequently restored, it fell into disuse since 1598 and stood as a ruined Ponte Rotto until, in 1852, it was again made to do service for some 20 years as a suspension bridge. The eighth bridge was the venerable Pons Sublicius, the oldest in Rome. It was constructed almost entirely of wood to facilitate prompt demolition in case of need. Owing to the many religious associations attached to it from the first foundation of the city, it was carefully guarded throughout heathen times, nor do we know how or when it fell into decay. Among many hypotheses as to its site, the most probable places it at the northern commencement of what is now known as the Ripa Grande. During the previously mentioned work on the Tiber, some ancient remains of piles, which had hitherto been visible there, were removed from the river. Until quite lately, too, some relics survived of the ninth ancient bridge, or Pons Probi. This led across the river to the so-called Mar Morata, to the neighborhood of the present San Michele Hospital. It was restored by the Emperor Theodosius and went by the name of Pons in Ripa Romiae. Thus, by aid of the latest research and discoveries, the question of the Roman bridges, one which formerly bristled with difficulties, seems in the main to have received a satisfactory answer. Among the seven hills of Rome, the Palatine, the first one to be built upon, forms a natural center. Towards the north, the Velia forms a sort of bridge or promontory attached to it. On the south, it is faced by the Aventine, whose higher parts and green slopes overhang the Tiber. The wide-stretching lower portion, where now the churches of St. Saba and St. Balbina stand, sinks toward the valley on the southeast as far as the Appian Way. Another hill, the Mons Capitolinus, rises on the northwest side of the Palatine. The fourth, or the Quirinal, was once united with the Capitoline on the northeast by means of a sort of ridge. This was, however, cut through in the time of the Empire, when Trajan's Forum was being built. The Mons Quirinalis extends rather far to the north and east, and forms a kind of plateau upon the eastern side. From this high ground, two other hills slope down towards the Palatine, the Viminalis and the Esquiline. The latter has two spurs, each with a name. The more northerly was called Cispius, the southerly Opius. The hollow between them was, in ancient days, called the Fatugal. Finally, the seventh hill, the Caelian, rising southeast of the Palatine, is separated from it by a valley of great depth. It has no connection with the other hills on the Palatine side, but subsides gently eastwards toward the Lateran, and is ultimately merged in the plateau just mentioned, which forms the eastern side of Rome. This plateau, between the Caesarian Palace, that is San Croce in Gerusalemme, and the Tiburtine Gate, was the neighborhood where almost all the aqueducts met. From such a height, it was easier to distribute the water throughout the city. The Pincian, a more distant hill to the north of the Quirinal, as well as the two heights on the right side of the Tiber, the Janiculus and the Vatican, are not included among the seven hills, at least not when speaking of the historical development of the city. As for the Mons Testaceus, at the southwestern angle of the city, it is not a natural eminence, but grew up after the time of Augustus, as its old name indicates, through the gradual accumulation of potsherds and rubbish from the huge emporium. The valleys between these hills were formerly much deeper than they appear now, and in the interest of traffic, the municipality is bent on equalizing still more the irregularities of the surface. Anyone in ancient days entering the city from the south by the Via Appia and proceeding thence through the Via Nova, that is the Antoniana, to the Circus Maximus, would have traversed the deep valley of the district called the Piscina Publica. Here he would have seen the several arches of Trajan's Bridge, towering well nigh 100 feet above him, and carrying the Aqua Marcia and Claudia from the Caelian to the Aventine. This aqueduct was last mentioned by the Einsiedel itinerary of the 8th century. If the traveler then bent his steps toward the Colosseum, he entered a valley between the Caelian and the Palatine, which, during the early days of the empire, was immensely deeper than the present one through which the Via di San Gregorio runs. In 1878, when the work of draining the Colosseum was in progress, remains of buildings belonging to the time of Nero were found in this vale, not less than 6 and 30 feet below the present pavement. The street constructed subsequently to Nero's fire was found at a depth of about 10 feet below the present surface. There were thus at this spot no less than 3 roads superposed. At this point, the valley was filled in during the first century of the Christian era. Constantine's triumphal arch was erected in front of the Colosseum upon ground already raised and across the then Roman thoroughfare. To pass through the triumphal arch, it was originally necessary to mount several steps, whereas the Via di San Gregorio now crosses it at a level. An aqueduct of Septimius Severus carried its water at a giddy height above this valley road on superposed arches, of which only the lower portion still exists. The gushing stream came from the Aqua Claudia on the Caelian and flowed across to water the imperial palaces on the Palatine. We may prolong our walk to observe the better how great an alteration has taken place in ground level. Nothing can give us so clear an idea of the change at Rome than the difference in this matter between the ancient and the modern city. Where the Colosseum now stands, there was once a hollow valley. Nero altered it into a magnificent lake, forming part of his golden house. In the northern wall of the Caelian, we can still see the openings whence the waters issued, which supplied the low-lying lake. Turning towards the Roman Forum, a spectator would have looked up at the lofty roof of the atrium of Vesta, lying in the valley beyond the Velia. Yet days were to come when there would have been here, instead of a valley, a pile of earth and rubbish rising 72 feet above the atrium. In fact, in excavating the house of the Vestals, a deposit 72 feet thick was cleared away above the principal hall. This is, so far as we know, the greatest height reached by the rubbish accumulated above Rome's antiquities. At the Quirinal Hill, modern building operations upon its declivities have brought a similar state of things to light. It was surrounded by hollows which, compared to the conditions prevailing now or even in medieval times, present a regular puzzle. When, for instance, in 1877, the long course of the Via Nazionale was laid between the Quirinal and the Viminal, behind the Porta Fontanellis of Servius, between the Magna Napoli and the Banca Nazionale, the excavators first came across the portions of the baths of Constantine. Under these was found the mansion of Avidius Quintus, deeper still, the house of a certain Claudius Claudianus, and finally, still earlier structures in Opus Reticulatum. This was at the southern angle of the Quirinal. At one point, on the northeast side, outside the Porta Colina, in the wall of Servius Tullius, the descent was once so abrupt that when laying the foundations of the northeastern wall of the new Ministry of Finance, it was found necessary to dig down nearly 40 feet of earth and rubbish before the bedrock was reached. Farther north, in the valley of the ancient Sallustian Gardens, between the Quirinal and the Pincian, we may even now enjoy the surprising sight of ancient structures emerging from the depression adjoining the modern Via Flavia. They are the halls of the vast Nymphaeum, which seems to have sunk down as though by magic. The ancient foundation soil on which they stand lies quite 40 feet below the present surface. A few instances of change of level about the churches will now be given. The Basilica of St. Vitalis, called formerly Titulus Vestinae, was erected in the beginning of the 5th century upon the southern slope of the Quirinal and stood a little above the valley street. At present, 36 steps lead down from the street to this church. Near the Basilica Pudenziana, which stood on the level of an old street called the Vicus Patricius, between the Viminal and the Esquiline, the ground is now so much higher that we gaze upon this witness of the church's earliest ages, lying at the foot of a staircase of 22 steps. The Esquiline Basilica, that is Santa Maria Maggiore, was built upon a knoll overlooking the valley formed by the Esquiline opposite the Viminal. Although the ascent is still noticeable, it was lately necessary when building the house standing at the south corner of the Via Cavour and the Piazza del Esquilino to dig down through more than 45 feet of accumulated rubbish in order to reach the original bed of rock. End of section 22. Section 23 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5. Outward Changes in Rome, a Retrospect on the City Under the Empire. Part 4. The Aurelian Wall. The repeated sieges of Rome, which we have already spoken of, afford more than sufficient proof of the importance of the Aurelian Wall for the continued existence of the city. This wall, which we can see and admire even at the present day, not only holds a lasting place in the annals of Rome, but is also, from both a topographical and monumental standpoint, one of the most important and most attractive memorials of the eternal city. The earliest city wall is that ascribed to Servius, a mighty product of the kingly period, but having a smaller area than the Aurelian Wall. Its course was mostly along the summit of the seven hills we have just described. As Rome subsequently had far outgrown this girdle, the emperors Aurelian, 270 to 275, and Probus, 276 to 282, spurred on by the menace of an invasion by the barbarians, who had already reached the Metaurus, enclosed the city within a wall of considerably greater length. This wall begins where the Tiber, descending from the north, reaches Rome nigh by the Flaminian Gate. At first it skirts the left bank of the river, along the Campus Martius, thence it continues past the Aelian Bridge, now the Ponte Sant'Angelo, to the Aurelian or Valentinian Bridge, now Ponte Sisto. Here it crosses to the farther side of the Tiber, turns back along the right bank, and ascending to the summit of the Janiculus, where its course is still shown by vast ruins, it attains the castle which once crowned the height, the Arx Janiculensis. Thence it takes a southeasterly direction, down to the Porta Portuensis, near to which the Tiber again flows away from the city. Thus only the southern portion of the right bank, the Trans-Tiberine region, was enclosed by the city wall, not the northern part where the St. Peter Basilica stands. The Vatican region was not surrounded by a wall till long after, and had good cause to regret its defenselessness. The Aurelian Wall recommences its course along the left bank, and from that point it is almost everywhere in evidence at the present day, though what we see has frequently been repaired and added to in later times and even to the present day. It first follows the course of the river southwards, then bending east, surrounds the Mons Testaceus, gives egress to the Via Ostia at the picturesque gate now called Porta San Paolo, and further on to the Via Appia and the Via Latina. Still bearing to the east, it arrives below the Lateran and the Caesareum at its farthest eastern limit, close to the exit of the Via Labicana and Via Praenestina. After this, by a northwesterly course, it reverts to the Flaminian Gate, from which it started, crossing on its way the Via Tiburtina, encircling past the Praetorian camp, next giving outlet to the Via Nomentana and the Via Salaria, and finally serving as a retaining wall to the Colus Hortulorum on the Pincian. Such is the famous stone girdle of Rome, on account of the restorations effected in 403 by Honorius. When the city was in even more imminent danger, this wall is sometimes called the Honorian Wall. The gates of this wall, at the time of Honorius, succeeded each other in the following order. The first was the Flaminian on the north, next came one at the Aelian Bridge, then on the opposite right bank, and still on level ground, the Porta Septimiana, which on its present site served as the southern entrance to the Vatican precincts. On the summit of the Janiculus stood the Porta Aurelia, and at its foot the Porta Portuensis, near the river. On the left bank of the river, the Porta Ostiensis, the Porta Ardeatina, the Porta Appia, the Porta Latina, the Porta Metrovi, and the Porta Asinaria succeeded one another in turn. The latter was quite close to the Lateran Palace, the residence of the Bishop of Rome, and therefore of great importance ecclesiastically. The gates in the wall as it proceeded north were the Praenestina, the Tiburtina, the Clausa, and the Nomentana. The northern portion of the wall had only two openings, namely, the Porta Salaria and the Porta Pinciana. This imposing structure, according to Lanciani's latest calculations, was rather more than 20,600 yards in length. It is noteworthy that a considerable part of the line of the wall was formed by earlier structures, which were utilized by Aurelian for motives of economy and hurry. Not only were several monuments standing actually upon the line of route built into the masonry, as, for instance, the superb sepulchral pyramid of Cestius at Porta Ostia, now Porta San Paolo, but whole ranges of previous walls were also incorporated with very slight alteration. This happened for a distance of 1,803 feet, with the ancient retaining walls of the Pincian Gardens, where to this day portions of reticular work earlier than the time of Aurelian may be seen here and there on the north side. The same thing happened at the Castrum Praetorium, where, for a distance of 1,148 yards, the beautiful fortified enclosure which Tiberius built round it does duty as the city wall. The arcades of the Aqua Marcia, between the Tiburtina and Praenestina gates, were simply filled in with masonry and included in the main circuit, thus saving a length of 874 yards. South of the Porta Praenestina, the arches of the Aqua Claudia again saved another 519 yards, while the artistic enclosure of the Apothecarium Castrense near Santa Croce supplied yet another 109 yards, and so on. According to recent computation, 3,132 yards were thus economized, or more than one-sixth of the entire circuit. That was the usual way of building at Rome in the latter days of the empire. A curious example of the precipitation with which the wall was erected came to light during the work at the Porta Tiburtina between 1882 and 1884. The back wall, more than 30 yards in length, of an ancient Nymphaeum was laid bare. It had been built into the defenses and was still in possession of its conche and water pipes, even with statues by no means devoid of artistic merit being still in their niches. The execution of that portion of the wall, which was entirely new, contrasts, however, favorably with this patchwork, being built with perfect harmony and great technical skill. At intervals of 100 Roman feet, strong towers are placed, which, the better to defend the wall, project above and beyond it. They are mostly square, but occasionally round. There are altogether no less than 381 of them. The wall itself averages 53 feet in height. Both the towers and the wall are brick-built. In its lower and more massive parts, the wall reaches an average thickness of about 4 yards. A lofty open gallery ran all round the interior side, roofed over with arches, supported by strong buttresses. This gallery is still visible in many places. Loopholes, or finestrae, narrowing outwards, open from the gallery onto the exterior. The arches of the gallery supported a second and smaller gallery, along which, behind the battlements, sentinels could pace from tower to tower. This upper walk was reached by stairs inside the tower. After these fortifications had been restored under Honorius in 403, the geometrician Ammon issued a short official account of the work. This is still preserved to us in the famous Einsiedel Codex, but the text has been slightly altered in the 8th century, about the time of Pope Hadrian, to bring it into closer conformity with the state of the wall at that date. According to Ammon's minute statistics, the early parapet had 7,020 embrasures, or propunacula. Besides the loopholes used by the archers, there were 2,066 larger openings for the engines, or finestrae maiores. Besides the gateways enumerated above, there were 5 small entries, or posternae, and 126 necessariae, or closets, projecting beyond the wall. The small gates or posterns were doubtless convenient, but were also a danger to the city. Previous to the work of restoration undertaken by Honorius, they had been very numerous. Most of them had been opened in deference to private claims, and to serve as a passage wherever there was right of way through the ramparts. the Emperor Honorius suppressed all save these five, which opened on to the Tiber and were thus more easily safeguarded. The rest, as can be seen in places to this day, were closed with massive masonry. To strengthen the defenses, the soil without was in some places removed to a certain depth, whilst elsewhere piles of accumulated ruins were carried away. Everywhere damaged portions were repaired and injured towers rebuilt. Above all, attention was bestowed on the gates. Several of these gates still display certain common features in their semicircular flanking towers and rows of equal-sized, round-arched windows above the entrance. In their main lines, they probably date from the time of Honorius. The Porta Appia belongs to this group, but here the later restoration of its towers must be taken into account. The lower portions of this gate and of its towers are still clad in a splendid marble facing. The marble blocks were probably purloined by Honorius's architects from the Temple of Mars, which used to stand on the Clivus Martius outside the gate to the left. If this temple was not already in ruins, it was sacrificed exceptionally because from its position just outside the walls, it could have afforded a good vantage ground to an attacking force. The stretch of wall bearing the fewest traces of alteration under Honorius and even during subsequent centuries is that portion standing between the Salarian and the Pincian gates. This part, as well as that by the Lateran and the portion behind the Mons Testaceus, best serves the purpose to the present day of impressing us with the gigantic scale on which the work of Aurelian and Probus was planned. These massive, melancholy ruins, after more than 1,500 years, still invite the thoughtful traveler to conjure up visions of all the vicissitudes which Rome has experienced within and around them during the lapse of so many ages. The ramparts of Rome tell tales of a checkered career. They bear silent witness to all the great events of the world, of which they have experienced the reaction, especially to the repeated onslaughts of the German North. Reverting to the period with which we are now dealing, they tell of the difficult and tearful transition from ancient to medieval ecclesiastical Rome, inseparably associated with the name of Honorius and his successors. End of section 23. Section 24 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5, Outward Changes in Rome, A Retrospect on the City Under the Empire, Part 5. The 14 Regions. During the 5th and 6th centuries, conformably with the phase of transition from classical to ecclesiastical Rome, two distinct fashions of dividing the city were in vogue. The old one, introduced by Augustus, reckoned 14 regions, whilst the new ecclesiastical one counted only 7. The latter system probably came into use as early as the Roman bishop Fabian, towards the middle of the 3rd century, being connected with the appointment of the 7 deacons for the Roman parishes. This ecclesiastical division of the city, which is involved in considerable obscurity, must, however, be reserved for examination later. This is the place for a retrospective glance at the ancient Augustan system, which serves as a groundwork to the student, either of the pagan or early Christian topography of Rome. When the Emperor Augustus divided the city into 14 regions, he relied upon certain well-known lines of demarcation which stood ready to hand. Such was, above all, the course of the Wall of Severus. This ancient rampart was enclosed afterwards within the far more extensive Wall of Aurelian, and the oldest thoroughfares led direct to its different gates. The Wall of Severus thus served to divide the city inside its circle from the already important districts lying outside it. The valleys between the hills were also well calculated to furnish Augustus with clear boundaries by which to separate the different quarters. 4 of the regions were outside the walls of Servius. 5 were wholly inside it. 5 were partly inside and partly beyond it. As for the 14th region, it was formed by that portion of the city lying on the right bank of the Tiber. Each region was divided into vici, each of which had its own laris compitalis, of which the aediculae stood in the street. In early times, each vicus was governed by 4 magistri, According to Constantine's list, each region had 48 magistri and 2 curatores. For police purposes, there was 1 cohort of vigilis and a barracks for every 2 regions. The first region lay mostly outside the wall of Servius, between the Caelian and the Via Appia. The second was largely inside and comprised the Caelian. The third region, also inside, stretched over the Oppius to the Cispius. The fourth region was also situated inside and included the Suburba Valley and the Sacra Via. The fifth was outside on the Esquiline. The sixth was inside on the Quirinal and the Viminal, outside on the eastern Pincian. The seventh outside, between the Quirinal and the Via Flaminia. The eighth inside, between the Capitol and the adjoining Great Forums. The ninth outside, between the Via Flaminia and the Tiber. The tenth inside, on the Palatine. The 11th also inside, with the plain of the Circus Maximus down to the Tiber. The 12th and 13th, partly outside and partly inside, with the whole of the Aventine, the latter, after Augustus, or perhaps Claudius, enclosing the south-lying quaysides and warehouses, or Horaea. Finally, the 14th, as already stated, occupied the farther or right bank of the Tiber. Passing on to a short sketch of each region, we may say that the first was called Porta Capena, from the name of the gateway in the wall of Servius, comprised within its boundaries, and through which the Appian Way passed out of the city. This ancient and long-sought city gate was found in 1867 by an Englishman, J.H. Parker, during some excavations upon the flank of the Caelian. Apart from the wall itself, the boundaries of this region were, on the one hand, that part of the Appian Way, from the little river Almo up to the above-named gate. On the other, the ancient road leading through the wall of Aurelian at the Porta Metrovi, or Metrovia. The commencement of the Via Appia was the most important street in the quarter. It was the route followed by Christian pilgrims on their way to the catacombs of St. Callistus, Domitilla, and St. Sebastian. Striking pagan sepulchral monuments stood all along the Appian Way, starting from the Porta Capena. Not far from the Servian Gate, they were interrupted by the aqueduct over the so-called Arch of Drusus, and by the towering Porta Appia behind it in the Aurelian Wall. The second region, also known as the Caeli Montium, was bounded by the outer wall from the Porta Metrovi to the Porta Asinaria, by the present Via di Santi Quattro, or Street of the Four Saints, which is very ancient, and by the Via Triumphalis, or present Via de San Gregorio. The Lateran Palace stood at the eastern boundary of this second region, and as early as the first half of the 4th century was the residence of the Bishop of Rome. Beside it rose the magnificent Basilica of St. Saviour, built by Constantine the Great. In this Caelian district, the Anicii, among others, had their home, as the reader already knows, on the brow of the hill overlooking the Via Triumphalis. To the left, on the other side of the cliff Escauri, the Temple of Claudius, built on unusually massive substructures, rose behind the house of Pomachius. In the background, the prolongation of the cliff Escauri leads through the Arch of Dolabella to the Palace of the Valerii and to the Macellum Magnum and the present circular church of the proto-martyr St. Stephen. The third district was called Isis and Serapis, to a temple dedicated to these deities, the site of which has never yet been identified with any certainty. It appears to have stood between the Caelius and the Oppius. One boundary of this district was formed by the Servian Wall, namely, from the Porta Caela Montana to the Esquiline Gate, that is, up to the Arch of Gallienus, beside San Vito. The rest of the boundary is fixed by the course of ancient roadways, which can still be traced under streets of the present day. The Flavian Amphitheater belongs to this district, that colossal and world-famed building whose remains alone would suffice to immortalize the grandeur of the ancient monuments at Rome, the Baths of Trajan, and the Porticus Liviae, adjoining them to the northeast, were also among the noble edifices of this region. The fourth was called Templum Pacis, on account of the temple built by Vespasian, which contained it, and which bore this name. A part of the Viminal and the Suburba Valley, that is, the low ground between the Palatine and the Velia on one side, and the Oppius and Cispius, with the Faguta on the other, belonged to this region. The glory of this fourth district was the Sacra Via, bordered by magnificent mansions. The Sacra Via was the oldest highway in Rome and passed from the Flavian Colosseum through the Arch of Titus in the direction of the Forum Romanum. The fifth district was called Esquilae because it embraced the whole summit of the Esquiline lying outside the Servian Wall. On one side it was bounded by a strip of this wall from the Porta Viminalis to the Esquiline Gate, and thence farther to the Porta Caelimontana, on the other side by two ancient streets, which led respectively from the Porta Viminalis to the Porta Clausa of the Aurelian Wall, and from the Porta Viminalis to the Porta Asinaria of the same wall. In this district, the Mycelium of Livia and the Nymphaeum of Alexander, or Trophaei di Mario, in the foreground, and at the back, against the Aurelian Wall, the Amphitheatrum Castrense, and the Caesarian Palace of St. Helena, where now stands the Church of Santa Croce in Gerusalemme, deserve to be mentioned. The sixth region was Alta Semita. This was the old name of the path leading straight across the Quirinal Heights. At present, the broader roadway is called Via del Quirinale, and farther on goes by the ill-omened name of Via Venti Settembre. Among the monuments and pleasure grounds of this district, the most celebrated were the two vast thermae of Diocletian and of Constantine, the Sallustian Gardens, the lofty temple of Quirinus, which has vanished without a trace, but which stood on the site now occupied by the garden of the Quirinal Palace, and the temple near the mansion of the Colonna family, of which the grand ruins, called the Temple of the Sun, have survived the Middle Ages. Finally, the Castrum Praetorium, the easily recognized Praetorian camp near the Aurelian Wall, an entrenched piece of ground of tragic celebrity in the history of Imperial Rome. The seventh region was called Via Lata. Originally, this name designated a road or a neighborhood, probably as the name of the old church, Santa Maria in Via Lata, seems to indicate, the lower course of the Flaminian Way. The boundaries are easily given. The long line of the Via Flaminia and the stretch of the Servian Wall from the Porta Ratumena in the Via del Marforio below the Capitol to the Porta Fontanellis and then upwards along the Quirinal Heights. On the Pincian Hill, or Colus Hortulorum, which was a part of this district, the Pincian Palace once stood and for a time was the residence of Belisarius. In the ground level in the middle of the region, the portico of Agrippa enclosed the Campus Agrippae. It also comprised the portico of Vipsanius, and to the south, the grand portico of Constantine. An aqueduct called Forma Virginis traversed the region upon the piers, which are still partly standing. It went on to the neighborhood of the Pantheon to supply the baths, ponds, and fountains of the Campus Martius on the farther side of the Flaminian Way. The eighth district, Forum Romanum, or Magnum, is sufficiently described by its name. As usual, the boundary starts with the Servian Wall, beginning at the Porta Fluminata, behind St. Gala, to the Porta Ratumina, and including what was later on to be known as Trajan's Forum. The other limits are the Forum Transitorium, the Argoletum as far as the Janus on the Roman Forum. After this, the Sacra Via, the Arch of Titus, the Nova Via, meaning not the modern street, but that excavated in our day, and which passed under the ancient arch between the Palatine and the House of the Vestals. Finally, the Vicus Tuscus and the Forum Borarium. The buildings of this region, of which the list in the Constantinian catalogue is tolerably complete, have been already mentioned. The ninth region is the Circus Flaminius. The circus which gave its name to the district lies in its southern portion. Of this huge structure, only a little remains under the two modern palaces of the Matiae and Gaetani. The Via del Botte Oscure reminds us by its name of the northern arcades of the Flaminian Circus, along which this street formerly passed, while the name of Via dei Funari perpetuates the memory of the cord makers to whom the circus was turned over during the Middle Ages. In this district, as well as in the adjoining seventh, there is not the slightest difficulty in determining the boundaries. They follow the line of the Via Flaminia, which divides the ninth from the seventh district, then the Tiber and the short length of the Servian Wall from the Porta Flumentana to the Porta Ratumina. among the magnificent buildings once situated in the Campus Martius, which belongs to this district, we must call special attention to the Theater of Marcellus, which, disguised as a palace and stronghold combined, contrived to outlive the Middle Ages, the Theater of Balbus, of which some remains are still visible, Pompey's Theater, Domitian Stadium, that is Piazza Navona, the Pantheon, that grandest and best preserved temple of all classical antiquity, which, when situated in the midst of an open space, must have been incomparably more impressive than at present. Also the Thermae of Agrippa, near the Pantheon, those of Nero and of Alexander, in the vicinity of San Salvatore in Thermis, the Saepta Iulia, the Odeum of Domitian, and the Mausoleum of Augustus, standing to the north near the Flaminian Gate, and still fairly well preserved. Finally, the vast porticos of Octavia, of Philip, and of Pompey. The superb column of Marcus Aurelius, still almost intact, supported statues of the emperor and his wife Faustina, which looked down upon a brilliant circle of other porticos, among which that of Vipsanius and that of the Argonauts were the most important. At present, unfortunately, the lower part of the column is covered. The 10th district, Palladium, clearly derives its name from its situation on the Palatine Hill, bearing the imperial palaces. The central hill forming the district was surrounded by the Vicus Tuscus, the Nova Via, the Sacra Via as far as the Colosseum, then the Via Triumphalis and the Circus Maximus. Thanks to its gorgeous palaces of the emperors, this district had become the center of attraction in Rome. This imperial residence, occupied until the 3rd century by an uninterrupted line of emperors, comprised quite a series of individual palaces and mansions. For instance, the Domus Augusti, Domus Tiberii, Domus Caligulae, and the Domus Flaviorum. The lofty ruins of the Flavian building, with its vast halls, is still one of the most imposing monuments on the Palatine Hill. The great palace of Septimius Severus, between the Circus Valley and the Appian Way, made another. Mention must also be made of the stadium, perhaps more accurately called the Gardens of Augustus, which has only recently been excavated in its entirety, of the Adonis Gardens, the Septizonium of Severus, the Paedagogium, and a number of temples great and small. Both Odovacar and the Gothic king Theodoric took up their residences upon this regal hill. The 11th region, the Circus Maximus, is also defined and circumscribed by its name. For, apart from the circus, it comprised only a small portion of the city lying to the northwest. The exact boundaries are the Tiber, from the Servian Porta Tregemina, a little to the north below Santa Sabina, as far as the Forum Borarium, then the outside of the circus and the northeast slope of the Aventine. On the eastern and narrower side of the Circus Maximus stood, until the late Middle Ages, a triumphal arch, which, according to an inscription reported in the Einsiedel Itinerary, it had been erected in honor of the emperors Vespasian and Titus to commemorate the subjugation of the Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem. This gigantic circus, once so full of life, is now one of the most ruined and unrecognizable of all the ancient monuments. In the broad expanse before us, imagination finds it difficult to evoke even a glimpse of its faded glories. The stretch of wasteland, desolate and dishonored, seems to stand in flagrant contradiction to its pristine splendor, of which ancient writers tell so much. The Emperor Constantine restored and beautified this circus, and, according to Cassiodorus, public games were held here even in the 6th century. In the northern division of this 11th region lay the Velabrum, that is, the wide valley below the Palatine, where the Church of St. George in Velabro was erected at an early date, taking its name from its situation. Constantine had already built in this valley a large marble hall, the so-called Janus Quadrifrons. Thanks to this hall and the venerable church, as well as the Cloaca Maxima, which here enters the Tiber, an air of hoary antiquity pervades the whole spot and consoles us for the ravished Circus Maximus. The name of the 12th region was Piscina Publica, from a pond which existed from time immemorial in the hollow lying between the Servian Wall and the Baths of Caracalla. The district was bounded by the Appian Way, by the road leading to the Porta Ostiensis, and by the Aurelian Wall, from the gate last named, to the Porta Appia. These baths of Caracalla, at present the biggest thermal ruins in Rome, form the chief point of interest in this region. The Constantine catalogue includes in this district a Domus Salonis, the house of this favorite of Septimius Severus, which also appears in the fragments of the Severian plan, was identified with tolerable certainty in 1884 in the outbuildings of Santa Balbina. The station of the fourth cohort of guards, or vigilis, mentioned in the catalogue, may, by inscriptions, may be shown to have been situated near the church of St. Saba, on the pleasant hill opposite St. Prisca's. The 13th region is the last upon the left bank of the Tiber. It is called Aventinus, from the hill upon which it was largely situated. Its boundaries were the Aurelian Wall, from the Porta Ostiensis to the Tiber, then from the river up to the Porta Trigemina. After this, the northwestern and northeastern slopes of the Aventine, and finally the road leading back to the Porta Ostiensis. The celebrated Temple of Diana stood on the crest of the Aventine, for which reason the poet Martial calls this hill Diana's Mount. The much-disputed temple of Jupiter Dolichensis seems also to belong to this neighborhood. All along the level ground adjoining the river were wharves and warehouses for the seaborne trade of the metropolis. Though the situation of this ancient emporium had been known long before, it was only since 1883 that it has been opened up almost in its entirety. The ancient salt stores were also quite near the Porta Trigemina. Strange to say, this spot served for the storage of salt all through the Middle Ages, and even later, the name of Salaria Vecchia still recalling one of the oldest edifices in this region of Rome. In old days, there was here a special wharf for the marble trade, the so-called Marmorata. In 1867, no less than 493 blocks of marble, some rough-hewn and some worked, were found embedded here in the river sand, not a few being of great value. The Aemilian portico was devoted to the corn trade. Enormous stores of corn, wine, oil, and other foodstuffs were piled up here in numberless horia, or warehouses. Among these, the Horia Galbiana continued in use until quite late in the Middle Ages. 16 names of warehouses, believed to have been situated in this neighborhood, have come down to us. Other names, such as Porticus Fabaria, Vicus Frumentarius, Ansarium, or Custom House, all of which belong to this region, clearly prove this spot to have been the center of trade and business. The 14th district, called Trans-Tiberum, was the only one on the right bank of the river and comprised all its inhabited territory, as well as the Tiber Island. It stretched north as far as the gates of Domitia. The Janiculus and the Vatican belonged to it as far as their summits. Being so close to the river, it shared in the trade of the 13th region on the opposite bank. Big warehouses lined the quays, and businessmen had offices close at hand. The extent of the traffic may be gauged by the accumulation of broken amphorae. The Church of San Francesco in Ripa is wholly built upon these fragments. At the same time, a brisk retail trade was carried on in the narrow, densely populated streets of the region. A great many Jews had settled among these mariners, dyers, potters, and other small dealers. Indeed, the Jewish ghetto continued to be situated in the Trastevere even during the Middle Ages. It is highly probable that this quarter formed the starting point of early Christianity in Rome. So dense was the population of this region that the Constantinian catalogue assigns to it 78 vici, that is, streets or groups of streets. The 11th district, which stands next in point of population, had not even half the number, having only 35. The gem of the 14th district, and indeed of the whole city, was the garden-crowned summit of the Janiculus, commanding an extensive view. "Here," says Martial, "thou canst gaze down with delight upon the seven sovereign hills. Here thou dost perceive the grandeur of Rome." End of section 24.